It's time for Skin in the Game, and we have your front row seat to the action with marketing expert John Simperman and sports business journalist Tim Oshai.
They're talking about a $1 billion renovation.
Which is incredible.
And that's
for a hockey arena in the South, too, right?
That includes hotels.
Skin in the Game brings you the fresh and fascinating business news in the world of sports, a multi-billion dollar industry that has an economic impact on all of us.
This week on Skin in the Game, John and I welcome leadership from USA Fencing to talk about the pipeline from youth fencing clubs to the Olympic podium.
The sport has become one of the fastest growing sports in the Olympic and Paralympic movement post-Paris.
And how the organization is expanding the sport across the United States.
It's really exciting to see all of the fencing community kind of rally behind growth of the sport. It's not just in one part of the country, it's the whole country is doing it.
Coming up next on Skin in the Game, right after this.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Holiday Valley has winter fun everyone can agree on. Holiday Valley was voted the number 4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. Holiday Valley features mountain coaster rides, snow tubing, the Tamarack Club Spa, and of course, skiing and snowboarding. At Holiday Valley, you can just relax too. Winter starts here. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. I'm your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim Oshai.
Tim, how are you doing today?
John, I'm doing great. I've got some news for you, which we're going to get to shortly.
But before we get to the news, I do, again, want to acknowledge our partner, Holiday Valley. As winter slowly comes to a close here in our neck of the woods, it's been a great partnership with Holiday Valley. And also want to remind our listeners that it's really a four-season resort. So as spring starts to arrive, it's still a great time to get down to Holiday Valley. And speaking of which, a few weeks back, Tim, Holiday Valley hosted us for our Olympic episode, which also featured Adam Page, 3-time USA Paralympian gold medalist. And not sure if you've been watching, but USA hockey Paralympic team is dominating right now, dominating at the Olympics.
Yeah, they sure are. I have been watching a bit, especially after our time spent with Adam. And, even John, if we go back almost a year ago on Skin in the Game, we had Greater Buffalo Adaptive Sports, Adam's home organization founded by his family. An incredible center for adaptive sports, right? And so it's been on the radar. But yeah, I mean, the U.S. men right now are just crushing it, which I don't think is a surprise.
No. But, who else is crushing it is our friends to the north, Canada. They're also
not a surprise, by the way.
Also not. They're dominating games by 10, 11, 12 goals. So I got a hunch we might see another USA-Canada showdown.
I think it's time for yet another USA-Canada showdown. How else could it be in the Olympics?
Yeah.
Especially Olympic hockey.
The one thing, though, we have noticed with some of the athletes, especially on the ski hills, is this Winter Olympics is a little bit later, and as we're venturing into spring, and there has been some concern, as you start to push the Winter Games later, that you lose some of the conditions, right? The snow conditions, the weather conditions. So, I think it's something to really keep an eye on at, future scheduling and future Olympics.
Yeah, and here's hoping they push it up. Not only for the safety and the performance of the athletes, but drawing more fans in too, more viewers, more people in the stands. There is that winter sports, psychology. And, John, I don't know about you, but I'm sitting here in the office right now and it's 60 degrees outside and the sun is beating in through the window. Right. And I have no complaints about that, but it doesn't exactly scream winter sports.
Right. Speaking of Olympic sports, I do want everyone to stay tuned to this episode because we are going to be talking with the leadership of USA Fencing, Phil Andrews, who is the CEO, and Brad Sikorsky, who is the Director of Membership and Growth, to talk about what is really a fast growing sport in the US. And Tim, as I challenge you in the last year here on Skin of the Game, trying to get you out on skis, trying to get you out on, up on a bull, right, for bull riding, challenge you to some mountain biking. Maybe I just found your sport, fencing. What do you think?
I mean, that does come up in the episode. Yeah, you and Phil and Brad were trying to get me to go fencing. And John, I did it. And that is the news. That's the news I told you I had for you. I went fencing.
Okay. You got to tell me.
For people who can't see John right now, there's a look of disbelief.
I'm trying to picture Tim in this white, tight suit with a sword.
Don't do that part.
Give us the experience. How was it?
Oh, it was so cool. So first, I want to give a thank you and a shout out to Les Amis Fencing Club. That's French for friends, like Friends Fencing Club. Les Amis Fencing Club in Buffalo, New York, specifically Hamburg, New York. That's a suburb of Buffalo, for those who aren't familiar. The folks at Les Amis, Bill and his friends, had me over. It was a connection through USA Fencing. As people are about to learn when they hear our conversation, USA Fencing, actually, they have a website where you can go to learn how to try fencing, learn where to try fencing. So I did it. I went out there with a friend, and there's three types of fencing. There's saber, there's foil, and there is épée. And John, I know you're dying to know which one I did. You want to take a guess? Because they each had personalities attached.
I'm going to say saber, but where'd you go?
I wanted to, but if you remember, we decided I'm not a saber personality. That's like the slashing aggressive personality. As it turns out, I'm more of an épée guy. That's strategic, trying to poke at people literally in this case. Yeah. So the way it works, you get suited up. And you learn the footwork, and a lot of this is about the footwork, by the way. The toughest part isn't, to me at least, trying it one time, what you do with the weapon. It's what you do with your feet to allow you to get that weapon close enough to your sparring partner, right?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it's was I good at it? I was 1 hour in, so no, I wasn't, but it's fun. I want to do it again. And and I mean, it's a cool collection of people who do it too. I want to throw this out there. One of the fencers was a philosophy professor at the university, and he was telling me, there's a certain type. It's introspective, kind of intellectual, individualistic types of people, because fencing is very much an individual sport. But as Les Amis suggests, you do it amongst friends, and this is a way they come together.
Wow, that's cool. Hey, Tim, congratulations. I think we may have found your next vocation.
Next, though. They extended me an invitation, John, for you to come out.
Well, I think I definitely got to be a saber. I definitely got to be a saber.
I'll grab a saber too.
All right, we'll do our thing. Before we get to our guests, the leadership of USA Fencing, just a couple of stats here for our listeners. This is one of only three sports that has been in every Olympics since 1896. And in 1999, they had roughly 19,000 members across the United States participating. Last year, 2025, 45,000 participants, which was the largest growth number, the largest number of participants in fencing in their history. So I thought it was really important that we bring Phil and Brad on the show. We talk a lot about stick and ball sports and puck sports, but it's really cool to kind of broaden out the conversation and, give our listeners and our viewers a little bit of insight into what else is happening out there in sport.
And John, I want to add, it is very much a sport that you can begin as an adult. It's great for kids. There's great programs out there for kids, but you don't need to be a kid or even a young adult, a teenager. You don't even need to be in your 20s or early 30s. You can start this much later in life. And some of the people I met did that. They're passionate. They do it. They break a sweat. They have a lot of fun. And there is opportunity to actually move up and compete if you want to do that too, regardless of your age. We'll get into that in the conversation with
Brad. We will. And what is interesting is USA Fencing is responsible for everything from grassroots, which is what you participated in, all the way to choosing the Olympic team. So every step of the way. And what we'll also talk a little bit about is the sport is growing among the youth ranks, high schools. You're now starting to see colleges add fencing. And I think it's great because, you know, there are some individuals and some personalities that this sport really appeals to versus, you know, some of the other sports, be it football or hockey for that matter.
Yeah, John, that's so true. You know, I remember a story that I wrote 2-3 years ago on young people who were training in luge, the Olympic sport of luge. I met a young man, a middle schooler, who was, you know, was a theater kid, who was a science kid, who really cool kid, really smart kid, really accomplished kid, found luge, which is an individual sport, much like fencing, loved it enough to become part of the junior USA national team. Regardless of your age, whether you're a parent looking for a sport for your child or a adult looking for a sport for yourself, this could be a great sport. And by the way, if it's not you, it's still a great sport. It's incredibly social.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Tim, congratulations for taking us up on the fencing challenge. I'd really encourage our listeners, please stay tuned here to Skin in the Game. We're going to be discussing everything fencing with the CEO of USA Fencing, Phil Andrews, and the Director of Membership, Brad Sikorsky. Stay tuned to Skin in the Game.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Whether it's a beginner's or Black Diamond Trail, Holiday Valley features skiing and terrain at every level. There's also a team of snow sports instructors available to sharpen your skills and build your confidence. Holiday Valley was voted the number 4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. Winter starts here. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Welcome back to Skin in the Game, and thrilled to introduce our guest here today, Phil Andrews, the CEO of USA Fencing, and Brad Sikorsky, who is the Director of Membership Service and Growth. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us on Skin in the Game.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us on. We appreciate it.
Yeah, well, you know, we've been fortunate to cover, you know, a number of Olympic sports and governing bodies, but, you know, the opportunity to chat with you about what's happening in the sport of fencing and, you know, what hopefully will happen as we approach 2028, you know, really thrilled to have you guys join us. And maybe, Phil, if you could just kind of give us kind of the mission statement and the focus of USA Fencing.
Thank you. So USA Fencing is the national governing body, or NGB for short. We have a lovely alphabet soup in the Olympic world. If you pick out any few letters and put them together, they're probably something in what we do. So USA Fencing essentially looks after everything that touches the sport of fencing in the United States. So most people know us for mission 1, which is go and win lots of fun, shiny things in the Olympic and Paralympic Games every 4 years. Between that, we send 144 U.S. national teams around the world every year across 3 different weapons in able-bodied fencing and in para-fencing. And those range from our cadets, which is under 17s, all the way up to our vet 80s, which is the over 80 category. And then on the other side of the house, we have the mission of managing sport in the United States, which really comes into 2 things, which is the community and world of fencing in the United States and servicing that community, and then growing that community, growing the fan base, but also, of course, the participation in the sport of fencing.
Brad, you joined the organization, but you spend some time with a few other governing bodies, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I've been in the Olympic movement for over a decade now and got my start way back in the day interning for USA Hockey during the Sochi Olympics. And from there, went to the USOPC working at the Olympic and Paralympic Training Center. Ended up at USA Weightlifting and working in their membership department, overseeing growth initiatives or membership retention initiatives with USA Weightlifting. And overall, got to really experience sport and get my hands dirty in all sorts of areas, everything from working membership campaigns to starting and try weightlifting for free events across the country to really expose the sport to new folks. And it gave us quite a bit of opportunity to really go out there and try new things. And after that, I became the director of membership at USA Lacrosse, overseeing their membership department of over 400,000 members. And then when Phil became CEO of USA Fencing, I thought it was a great opportunity to work with Phil again and ultimately grow the sport of fencing. Fencing being a membership base at the time, about 35,000 individuals. We've since grown that to 45,000 plus at this point. Our goal and our mission is to grow the sport of fencing at the grassroots level, but also at the elite level. So it's been quite a journey on our end.
So guys, thank you for being here. Talk to us a little bit about what that looks like to grow it. And let's start at the grassroots level. What kind of efforts are you making to get people involved in the sport? And are we talking youth? Are we talking youth and adults?
Tim, I'll go ahead and answer that one, because I think there's different strategies for different target markets that we go after. Ultimately, what we do as a national governing body is really to support the clubs and their business in growing the sport of fencing. Because ultimately, bringing new members, new families, new athletes into those clubs brings new business to them, which makes their club more sustainable and long-term, provides that pipeline for USA Fencing. We do everything from digital marketing campaigns. We've recently done a radio marketing campaign through some of our partners that you guys may have heard through iHeartRadio.
Yep.
To get people to try fencing. And that goes directly to our Find a Club page. And so anybody who heard that, regardless of what part of the country you're in, you can go to tryfencing.org and find a club near you, essentially, everywhere from Boston down to Orlando, to Austin, to Denver, San Francisco, you name it. At this time, we have over 750 clubs. We've grown our number of clubs by about 100 over the last couple of years, which is really a testament to a lot of the work that we've done in the background.
Brad, I read a little bit about this Fencing Across America. Was this a kind of a grassroots tour? Tell us a little bit about that.
If you don't mind, I'll actually hand that over to Phil, because that was kind of his brainchild on that one.
Yeah, so Fencing Across America, the idea was to somewhat a little bit make history, but to somewhat bring the games home. So with the Olympic Games, a lot of people see it on TV, on NBC or USA Network or CNBC or whatever they might be, or Peacock indeed these days, but they never have a chance to interact with those games. They'll see an interesting sport like a fencing or a weightlifting or whatever it might be that catches their eye, but they don't actually have a way to say, okay, do I like that sport? Do I not? From a participation standpoint, we decided that we were going to take that on the road. And we had 15 sites across 13 cities, if my math is correct, or my memory is correct, both of which might be questionable. And essentially put out an experiential marketing campaign to allow people to go about their day after seeing the games, whilst those games were still going on, and actually experience the sport for themselves. So in other words, we were set up in, for example, Grand Central Terminal in New York City, the Mall of America in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the OC Vibes in Orange County, California, out in Anaheim, and then places in as diverse places as Cleveland, Portland, Oregon, Denver, Colorado, and so on. And then you could show up and basically try fencing as part of your daily life. And we had a pretty significant showing over the course of those days that the games was going on. I think more people tried fencing in that week than ever tried fencing before.
What kind of feedback do you guys get from people when they try fencing? What do they like about it? What surprises people about the sport?
I think it's how quickly you can get into combat. So if you go and try fencing, something I've heard fairly consistently is that you can actually do it in 20 minutes. Does it mean you can master it 20 minutes? No, I sort of compare it to the piano. You can do a scale in just a few minutes, but you can't necessarily master it in a few minutes. It takes years to do that. So that's one. The second piece is something quite unusual. It's fun to try. You have to wear a mask. You have to get, essentially a suit of armor on. The imagery resonates with people a lot. And then frankly, who doesn't want to go and stab people and make friends?
Okay, hey, I think, John, that might be my favorite quote from the last year and a half that we've been doing Skin in the Game. So
Phil and Brad, every time on the show, we've had the folks on from professional rodeo to skiing and to bobsledding, and every episode I challenge my co-host here, Tim, to try a sport.
Oh, I'll do this one. I'm there,
I think
like
we found
tomorrow.
It.
Oh yeah, no, we can make that happen. We highly encourage people to come and try it.
I was recently offered the chance to ride a bull in the rodeo. Fencing sounds way better, way, way better. I mean, the rodeo is really cool to hear about, but this one I'm going to take you up on.
Okay, so we got a lot to unpack here. So number one, in the case of fencing, you have an obligation because you're in Buffalo, which means you have a team named the Buffalo Sabres.
Oh, there you go.
You have to go and try saber, which is also the one which is fastest, a slashing weapon. It's my favorite origin story in all of sports. So fencing comes from war. It comes from combat. It comes from the armies. The three weapons, épée was actually made by the French for sport. Foil was where you tried to pierce the Qingling armor. That's the history of it. And in saber, you had to slash the human in such a way that you could kill the human but steal his horse, which is the origin of sabers.
Gotcha.
So you have a choice, to be honest with you. You can go and try it, and you can simply try ordinary, reasonable saber fencing, or you can try the real origin of a saber. It sounds like with bulls and bobsleds and so forth, perhaps you should just try the old school version from the 1700s.
Just go all for it. Yeah.
That's
if
right.
it doesn't go well for me, I'll never have to ride the bulls.
So. Yeah. Well, and look, I'll give your horse a great home if you end up being successful.
Now, Phil, you brought up geography and are there hot spots geography-wise in the U.S. where fencing has had more history and more participation?
Well, for sure. I mean, we certainly, for the most part, call ourselves the sport of New York City. We've kind of given ourselves that on our own. The city of New York has not consented to that yet. We do send more athletes in the New York City to the games than, to my understanding, any other sport. It is certainly our number one city. We have about 20% of our membership comes from within about 40 miles of Grand Central Terminal. So in other words, Southern Connecticut, Northern New Jersey, and New York City. It is really the capital of fencing, arguably one of the biggest fencing cities on the planet, together with Paris, Milan, Moscow, Seoul, Tokyo. Other than that, Boston, now increasingly Miami, Houston, Dallas, for Paralympic fencing, Denver and Salt Lake City. And then out here on the West Coast, where I'm sitting right now, LA, San Diego, the Bay Area, particularly Silicon Valley, and then Portland. Portland's perhaps the interesting one of those. Every sport I find has that odd city which you can't really explain, but when you dig in, there's some rationale. Portland has become one of those cities for fencing. They produced Olympian in the last games. They've had Olympians and world team members pretty consistently for the last couple of decades. And a lot of it surrounds the success of a lady named Mariel Zagunas, who was essentially the greatest of all time in women's saber. So that dynasty started with her and has really moved on through now Shabbat Sullivan and Magda Skarbonkiewicz.
Yeah. And Brad, are you from a membership perspective? I mean, are there some up and coming kind of hot markets you've noticed with some of your grassroots efforts?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. I mean, Portland being named, I feel like Portland would be one of those cities that would be in the book, The Talent Code, just around that being a hotbed. But when we look at kind of growth, there's obviously growth in our deeply developed areas right now with the New Yorks, the Boston, but we're also seeing additional growth in the Midwest. The Midwest has become more and more fencers are coming out of it, especially with the amount of collegiate opportunities being in the Midwest, everywhere from Detroit down to Cleveland, Columbus, there's opportunities there. Chicago becoming a big hotbed as well. Denver and Texas. Texas has grown year over year around 20% in our membership. And it's really exciting to see what they are able to accomplish down there with those clubs, and new clubs are popping up as well. And one of the initiatives that we've recently pushed within the membership department is our club incubator and club accelerator programs. And so it's really meant to start up clubs around the country. We've recently started up 7 clubs total over the last year and a half. So we put clubs in areas that are looking to develop. Coaches are hungry to have a club. And then from a club accelerator standpoint, really helping out those clubs grow their membership. Our club accelerator programs are meant to help take over some of the more business aspects of this, of running a club. So that way the coaches that are the club owners can really focus on coaching.
How are kids getting involved, Brad? I mean, I'm sure clubs are one way, but how about exposure through school, after school programs, youth organizations?
Primarily right now, we are a club-based sport. So very similar to gymnastics in that sense. When we look at the exposure from a high school level, we have pockets around the country that are starting to grow a little bit more on the high school side, but primarily it's in New Jersey for high school. And New Jersey has a very robust high school fencing scene. They're the only state currently in the country that is a sanctioned sport at the high school level. Every year they have massive competitions. I believe that at this point they have over 200 schools that have fencing in the state of New Jersey. And so it's really impressive what they've been able to accomplish over the last couple decades here and just sustain and grow. We do provide services to get clubs into schools as well. We know schools are always looking for those after school type programming, and we're really excited in a couple months to be able to launch our first after school programming. We're going to be pushing out here soon. It does provide us an opportunity for growth, but primarily the high school is in New Jersey area.
How young are you going with the after school program that you're rolling out?
Yeah, we're looking at between grades 3 and 5.
Great.
And we have been seeing a growth in the age 7 to 12, so pre-high school age. About 20% of our membership growth has been because of that. And so looking at that group and the parents there, a lot of the parents that are putting their kids into fencing, it's because they're looking to give them an opportunity that maybe they don't like a traditional team sport. Maybe they don't like soccer, basketball, football, but they still want their kid to be athletic and they still want them to be part of a team, part of a club environment. And so that's where fencing kind of fits in for a lot of these families. It's an opportunity to have their kid become part of a community that they might not otherwise have.
It's interesting. We're with Phil Andrews, CEO, and Brad Sikorsky, Director of Membership, Service, and Growth with USA Fencing. I mean, that's a good segue, and I guess maybe, Phil, this is a question for you. When I think of fencing, I don't know, I kind of feel it's, at least the perception-wise, you know, it's an affluent sport, you know, it's like equestrian, like squash, right? I mean, but it sounds with the work Brad's doing, you know, we're trying to make the sport more accessible to more people. I mean, A, is that a fair perception? And maybe was that your perception before getting into the CEO role? And how are some of those perceptions we're trying to change?
Yeah, look, there's no question we are an affluent sport. And I think that there's a power in understanding who you are. It's very difficult for a national governing body to understand exactly who we really are as people, as demographics, as a sport. Ultimately, in the US, if you're going to be involved in sport where it's predominantly self-funded and you're going to have to travel for that sport, then that is where a lot of that cost is going to roll up. So the real winners end up being the likes of United, Delta, and American, and Avis, Sixt, and Enterprise, rather than necessarily the national governing body or its member clubs. We are very diverse. We are actually the most diverse sport in the NCAA. That's largely due to being the leading Asian American sport in the NCAA, and largely due to our large Asian American community in the sport itself across USA Fencing. I've come to the conclusion that we're better off leaning into the idea that we are indeed an affluent sport. That's where our clubs do best, is in affluent areas that can target families and the kids who do have the resources to be in fencing with its current setup, with its current travel schedule around the world, and then supporting foundations who can open up the taps on folks who otherwise can't afford fencing. We've had two of those launch recently with our backing. One here in Los Angeles, where I'm sitting with Nick Itkin, the Nick Itkin Foundation, his bronze medalist from the Paris 2024 Games, and the Eli Dershowitz Foundation up in Boston, which is led by a three-time Olympian and then graduated from Harvard, went to the 24 Olympics, his third, won a world championships, by the way, in 2023. And then he went and bought his hometown club, which I think is a beautiful story. And he approached us and said, hey, look, I want to do something similar to the Peter Westbrook Foundation in New York City. How can I do that? And we've been able to help him stand it up. Then in New York, PEAST, which is led by Nzinga Prescott, and Peter Westbrook's foundation, which famously has had an athlete on every Olympic team since 1988. And there is many more examples of those foundations, other than those athlete-led ones, across the U.S. So it's perhaps not what you expected to hear. There is a little bit of accessibility that's going on through those programs, yes, and we're very proud of that. And we do eventually want to start leaning into where we can make the sport accessible. How do we structure a second string or a second area of the sport that doesn't require travel? There is there's local opportunities available. There is ways to fence more affordably. But when it comes to the real thickness of the sport, those tend to require the additional travel to regional events, national events, eventually international events. So I do a scale. We do 130 plus regionals a year. We do 11 national and international events per year. We do 144 national teams per year across all of the different weapons and age groups. So that's a lot of travel. Plus you've got the club fees, you've got the club personal training fees, and so on.
Are there other sports, Phil and Brad, that have followed that trajectory? You know, they start as an affluent sport, embrace it, build it up that way. And ultimately, there's that tipping point where there's the resources and the geographic reach to start making it accessible to a broader audience, even at just like the most basic exposure level.
I think there's a deep down desire to make every sport accessible. I think that's where a lot of NGBs start and perhaps even end, if that makes any sense. The one that resonated most in my mind was probably US Ski Snowboard. A slightly different business model. Geographically, they're more challenged because, of course, you need a slope with some cold. I live in Colorado. It's not been a good winter, I can assure you. But you need some snow on a mountain or snow on a hill in order to ski. However, they have done a fairly good job of saying, look, you know, skiing is an affluent hobby more generally. Perhaps not quite as affluent as we're talking with US Equestrian. But it is an affluent hobby, and they've done a good job of leaning into making more resources available, trying to broaden their reach in those particular markets so they can target. Hockey, and I think Brad can speak more to that, is another one that feels like it's done a lot of work in that space. Those have both understood that they're generally a more affluent sport because of the necessity to do so. I'd probably say squash is one of those that has lent into, we are a sport that really has a resonation in that affluence, the area that we do, and probably US Equestrian too. And honorable mention to US Rowing, who I think have now turned that corner. They brought in a new CEO called Amanda Krause, who came from a background having founded Row New York, which is their version of the Peter Westbrook Foundation. So I think probably now having talked through that, I might even change my answer and say rowing is actually doing a really, really good job of that. But yeah, rowing, ski, snowboard, hockey, I'd say the three that really come to mind.
Yeah, Brad, could you touch on what you've seen with your days at USA Hockey or USA Lacrosse, where they've really tried to, you know, expand the reach and help with some of those resources?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think both NGBs do a really good job of providing grants to programs around the country and really making sure that they are following up with their grant participants or recipients, excuse me, to make sure that they are, in fact, growing the sport. Everybody wants to grow the sport. Everybody wants to make it more accessible. It's just making sure everybody is aligned and how to do that sustainably. And that becomes the challenge when you're looking at the sport ecosystem is you have a lot of people that do really good work. Some is more sustainable than others. And so from a national governing body standpoint, when we're looking at providing grants, when we're looking at working with organizations to provide access to individuals that may not otherwise be able to participate in the sport, we want to make sure it's sustainable. Because without that, we can put Sabres in a city in a club in New York. Maybe New York's not a fair example, but pick a city and say, here are your Sabres, go. But if you don't have the sustainable programming, if you don't have the sustainable coaching, if you don't have the sustainable pipeline of participants, the program starts and then ends in that same year.
What misconceptions do you find people have? And I know we talked about this before, but it sounds like an aggressive sport. It sounds like a dangerous sport. I gather that it's not, but I've also heard great fencers and including USA Fencing in your own materials describe it as, you know, very much a game of chess at the same mm-hmm. time. So talk us through some of that.
Yeah, I think it's quite a cerebral sport. The physical chess is kind of the name it gets, and often attracts people that you might imagine have that sort of personality, quite thoughtful types. You have engineers, lawyers, medical, CXOs. It tends to be where people end up as in fencing. And you know, that follows a lot of the universities that are big in fencing, Harvard, Columbia, Brown, Cornell, but then MIT as well. MIT is remarkably high ranked in terms of their fencing ability across all three divisions, despite being a D3, Johns Hopkins also. Yes, while you make the joke of stabbing a friend, and yes, we have that quite a bit in our world. But the reality is that there's a thickness to what you wear, so it doesn't really, you know, question marks, hurt. But the idea is you're trying to figure out the defense of the other person and trying to get past them. So that requires quite a lot of thought strategy rather than necessarily outright aggression. So it does tend to be a sport which is quite thoughtfully played, for want of a better terminology, and quite thoughtfully approached. And a lot of it is, what might my opponent do next, then thinking through that, and therefore what might I do next. So I think that's one perception that is definitely perhaps an issue. Number two is, we talk about the affluence, but tends to be male, tends to be Caucasian. And certainly we are very much not dominated by the sort of male Caucasian demographic anymore. We used to be. Now it's very much more spread into a quite diverse sport with a very significant Asian American community in particular, and women are growing at a faster rate than men at the moment, so that is helping us with gender equity as well. So I think that was probably the two that come to my mind. Brad might have others.
I'm just thinking, Tim and John, you guys need to start stabbing each other and see how it feels.
We do that after the show. That's fine. Yeah.
Phil and I don't come from the fencing world. And so we've had the opportunity to start fencing when we first came on board. And man, it's fun. It's a really good time. It's a good workout. I'm speaking as an adult, not as a child participant, obviously, but even as an adult, it's a lot of fun. It's a new community that you might not be otherwise exposed to as well. And so highly encourage you guys. And Tim, I want to see the video of you doing it. So,
yeah, right.
And with maybe on the buffalo or not for the rodeo, it's up to you.
There you go. We're with Phil Andrews and Brad Sikorsky, leadership of USA Fencing. So kind of on that note of the attributes of a fencer, I guess, Phil, you know, from what you've experienced, you know, what makes a great fencer? You know, what is it, mental? Is it physical? Is it agility? What makes an Olympic level fencer?
There's the basics, right? Dedication. It is a game of precision and skill. And that is, you need a degree of thoughtfulness. You need a degree of determination that you're going to continue to show up at the fencing club week in, week out, day in, day out. Yes, there is some physical attributes. FAS tend to be a little taller. Not always, but tend to be. Foilists tend to be shorter and more nimble, but again, not always. You tend to have a little bit more physicality in saber. So there tends to be a little bit of personality difference between those three. Epaists, and I think of an epaist, for some reason I always think of lawyers. You could take from that what you will, I guess, but there does seem to be a disproportionate amount of folks who go into law having been in epae. And then with saber, I think you see a little bit more creative arts. You see a little bit more determined. Maybe that's the wrong word. A little bit more large personalities often come through saber. I get told I'm a saberist. a lot. I was a goalie in hockey, so that sort of makes sense. And with foil, I think, you know, it tends to be the somewhat the happy medium between the two. Ultimately, it does come down to a lot of dedication, strategy, time, and I think natural ability is there, but it can be trained. There's also a degree of hard work. I think of Jackie Dobrovich when I said that. Mm-hmm. She's an Olympic champion out of northern New Jersey, New York City, sort of metro area. She won Olympic gold in Paris as part of our foil team, historically against Team Italy, which is kind of like beating the Americans in basketball. That is an athlete who made two Olympic games, became an Olympic champion. And the biggest single thing was her absolute determination to get to that level and execute on it. She had certainly, I'm not suggesting that Jackie isn't dedicated, isn't talented, but what she did was take the talent she had and really augmented it with that.
I'm totally trying to figure out now if I'd be a saber or more of an epee or a foil. It seriously though, it's cool to think about how personalities can be connected to, you know, to the type of fencing that you specialize in. Along
well, Phil,
those lines.
Well, I played hockey and rugby, so I'm assuming I'm a saber, right?
Probably, because people tell me I'm a saberist. I was a hockey goalie and a flanker in rugby. So I think
there we go.
Yeah, and John, you are a marketing leader. I'm getting all like Myers-Briggs minded here now. But yeah, you know, I mean, think about, you know, lawyers being, what did you say lawyers are, Phil? Foil? They tend to be foil?
No, F.A.
Epe, I mean, epe,
look,
right,
there's lawyers in FA and there's lawyers in Sabre too. But yeah. Like it is the sort of personality type, that very sort of technical, detail minded type person that tends to be most into Epe.
Yeah, and I'm thinking like you know, a great defense attorney who can just stir the jury might be Sabre. But I could keep going on this, but let me pull back a bit. One of the things we like to ask people about when they come in representing a sport, particularly, you know, if they're from the governing body of a sport, is, you know, when you are doing that grassroots, you know, marketing to families or those grassroots connections with families, what kind of life skills do you find your people are talking with parents about that, you know, kids or older fencers too will develop through the sport?
I think a big one, because it's so individual, is that individual responsibility to win or lose. It's almost the opposite of team sports. I teach you how to win as a team or lose as a team and work with others to as a team. I think, and don't get me wrong, I think there's huge value in that. But as an individual sport, that personal responsibility is a big part of it. That discipline, that idea of developing strategy, that sort of competition planning element of it as well. Which competitions do I go to advance the most? Where am I going to go to? Who do I need to fence in order to get better? Is a key part of that. Precision always comes to mind, and I'm not sure it teaches that necessarily, but it's a big part of the skill set that you need to be successful. But I think a lot of it that we hear resonates with fencers significantly is discipline and the individualistic responsibility is two of the bigger ones that come from it. And frankly, yeah, learning how to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, accountability, right?
I mean, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I've taken a few losses in my life and had to get back up again. And
yeah,
you know, when you've taken a loss being stabbed, that you probably need to get back up to stab somebody again. Something you need to do.
That's right. Get back, dust yourself off, and get back up again. Right.
That's right. That's right.
As we start to wrap up this conversation, just wanted to get kind of a sneak peek at what's ahead. I mean, sounds like we had some success internationally in the Olympics in 2024. And if you could just give us a preview of what we're looking forward to in Los Angeles.
The sport has become one of the fastest growing sports in the Olympic and Paralympic movement post Paris. And we're very proud of that. I'm very proud of the growth that we're continuing to see. And you've heard a lot from Brad on some of the growth things that he's getting into. As we look ahead, we're put an accelerator on. We talked about the radio deal. We're doing a couple of more marketing agreements like that. We have our first TV show now. We're leaning more into the corporate partnership as well, which helps us market because, of course, if you have a large partner who has fences as part of their marketing campaigns. What's actually happening is they're marketing, you know, John's widgets, but John's widgets is featuring fencing, therefore they're marketing fencing. Mm-hmm. We're looking ahead to the games in LA, and we think we can be quite successful here, perhaps even more so than we were in Paris. We're expanding our para-fencing involvement as well. We manage both the able-bodied and the Paralympic side of the house. And that's certainly an area where we could do with significantly more growth than we've had. I want to pass it to Brad to make sure he gets his chance to have a say on that. But it's a lot more of what you've seen, the emergence of fencing in the last couple of years. And frankly, you've thrown a hell of a lot of gas on that.
Mm. That's great. Brad, what's up for you the next 12, 18 months?
We're really excited about the games on home soil. It's a great opportunity to expose, I mean, the country to the sport, right? Not just our sport, but all the Olympic sports. And so we're really excited to roll out the Fence Across America campaign again during those games and do some other grassroots initiatives leading up to, during, and immediately after the games as well. Some of the things you might just need to stay tuned and Tim, John, we'll make sure that we get some sabers out to you guys so you can participate in those. It's really exciting to see all of the fencing community kind of rally behind growth of the sport. It's not just in one part of the country. It's the whole country is doing it. So it ultimately comes down to our grassroots and how we can support them.
Right. Phil Andrews, Brad Sikorsky, USA Fencing. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for joining us here on Skin in the Game. And look forward to getting in a duel with my co-host, Tim O'Shea, and thanks for hopefully providing one more sport I'm going to get him to try.
Thank you guys so much on both counts.
Thank you guys.
We appreciate you.
Thank you. Stay tuned for more here on Skin in the Game.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Holiday Valley was voted the #4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. More snowmaking, more lifts, more ways to play. Holiday Valley is a mix of exciting terrain on an independent mountain that brings out your best. From the first chair to the last run, Holiday Valley is what winter was made for. Holiday Valley, your winter done right. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, welcome back to Skin in the Game, and I'd like to thank Phil Andrews and Brad Sikorsky from USA Fencing to join us here. And Tim, you know, this was kind of a little bit of a breath of fresh air to, and for me, I learned a lot.
Yeah, me too, John. I mean, we've been on a bit of an Olympic stretch here. And of course, you know, the Winter Olympics just happened, and the fencing, of course, is a Summer Olympic sport. But yeah, just thinking about these sports that have such interesting pathways, right? Like how does somebody become a fencer? And I love that you took the guys deeper into this, and you asked a question that was in my mind, which is, you know, this seems like it's a rich person's sport. That does seem like the perception. I like the way you worded it, an affluent sport. I appreciate the honesty. Yeah, we embrace that this is an affluent sport.
Well, and
but we don't want to stay there, you know?
Right, you're right. But because there's so few fencers, right? You can't go on to a local sandlot and start sword fighting. So, you know,
need a little bit of equipment. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and unfortunately, it's not the cost of the equipment. It's not necessarily the cost of the facilities. But to compete, you need to travel. And that's where that, you know, unfortunately, that's where the affluency comes from, is just the ability to travel and to compete. So it looks like, you know, through foundations and grants. And I love this little Fencing Across America tour, because, you know, you walk into, in this case, Grand Central Station or Mall of America, and you stumble upon a fencing demonstration. You know, you're going to stop, you're going to ask. And it sounds like, according to Brad, you know, they've been adding new fencers, participants through that grassroots tour.
Which is such a great way to do it. You know, we've talked about how USA Luge has a similar program, but it's for kids. It's not for people of all ages. But yeah, they take luge in the summer months on the road. They use, you know, in their case, they use wheels rather than blades, so they can do it outside in the warmer weather. But yeah, taking some of these sports that really people may see on TV every 4 years, and they might see it in, you know, some social media videos, and giving them a chance to actually try it. Well, I was going to say I was hoping I stumble into a tri fencing opportunity, but it sounds like I have an open invitation now. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for making that happen, John.
That's
along
right.
with the bull riding.
Yeah. Just don't do both at the same time. Right? That could be dangerous.
Yeah. He was almost going there too. You know, yeah. Take your saber, be on the horse.
But I got to tell you, when I do, you know, if I'm channel surfing, if that's still a thing anymore, and if I stumble on USA Network or NBC and there's a fencing competition, I mean, I stop to look at it. It's very interesting for sure.
You know, another point that, you know, that Phil brought up is the uniforms, the gear, they're pretty captivating. I mean, you're essentially in, I don't think it's actual Kevlar, but it might be, but you're in this, you know, very thick material. And obviously your face is covered, you've got a mask. So it has this mystique to it, even in the look. And then if you actually watch what they're doing and how they score, and I mean, this is something to think about too. Like we talked about the three types of weapons, épée, foil, and saber. You know, with épée, you can hit anywhere on the body and you get a point. Foil and saber, it's really just upper body. So there's, you know, getting into that mental part of it, there's this whole chess game, this physical chess game, as they call it, going on, as they're trying to just, you know, get in there on each other. So,
yeah, interesting.
I mean, it's fun to watch from a distance and up close.
I guess when I think of fencing, as we talked earlier, I always think of foil, which is, you know, the jab, right? The
right.
fin, but épée and then saber. Now, I would be a saber just because it seems to be a little bit more freeform.
Mm-hmm.
I see you as a foil. I see you being more of that chess player. So I'm going to put you as a foiler and I'm going to be a saber.
I think you're right. And I'm sitting here wanting to be a saber. That's my... Here, we're going deep into the psyche of me.
Yeah.
I want to be a saber, John. I want to be like you, but...
No, seriously, with
some colleagues the other day, I did one of those personality tests, a pretty rigorous one.
Yeah.
And what did it tell me? Yeah, you're thoughtful, you're strategic, you like to gather information, so... I think you're right. I think you're
still
right.
Still got a shot. If you start training now... You know, we've got this, the Olympic Games in 2028. So, you know, hey, never say never, Tim.
That's a question we didn't ask them is, you know, if you do this sport as a midlife crisis and you happen to get really good at it, just how far can you go?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I think, speaking though of midlife crises, but being more serious about it, this does seem like a really accessible sport for, you know, people who are mid-career, mid-life, looking to get out there and be active.
Moving.
It seems like a great one.
Yeah. And it's funny because we talk a lot about skin in the game on, you know, kind of lifetime sports, right? Golf, tennis, I guess pickleball, right? This is a lifetime sport. And Phil Andrews, the CEO, even said, you know, there's a whole division of 80-year-olds who are still competing. So, you know, that's a real great attribute of the sport. And again, you know, not many people, you know, after high school put on a football helmet anymore or hit a fastball anymore. But this is a sport that you can, whether you're young, middle-aged or old, you can pick up and you can compete. And it does look like a heck of a workout. I will not take the fencers for granted. Not that I did, but now knowing, you know, the dedication and the time they put into this sport. It was a great conversation. And again, I want to thank USA Fencing for joining us.
And for everybody out there, thank you for joining us for yet another episode of Skin in the Game. We'll see you next week.
This is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Thanks for listening.